Gray speaking. I've got to go out of the office to look into something, and I could do with a second pair of eyeballs, I tell him. What I really need is the paranormal equivalent of a detective constable, but as I don't have one, that leaves you. Can you spare a couple of hours this morning? Or find a body you can send along to hold my hand through the finer points of examining a possible crime scene? Let me see. I hear him typing on an old rattly desktop keyboard. His calendar is probably as full as mine. He may have an office here, but he's still spending half his time in the ACPO suite on Victoria Street, and another quarter at the yard. I'm finishing my weekly activity report for my boss and his executive. Then there's a meeting at 11 this morning, but I'm not a key stakeholder. I'll send my apologies and come along. Are you sure about this? Not entirely, but the British Transport Police seems to think it's a job for us. Well, if they say so, it must be true. He camps it up just a little, and I stifle a laugh. Personally, I think it's a job for 14 times, but BTP seem to think we're some kind of official bizarro world division. So, unless we can shrug this one off on the missing property office. Missing property? Why would they be involved? I tell him about the missing tube station, and we agree to meet there at 9:30. I pause just long enough to grab my coat and violin case, and then it's out onto the uncharacteristically sodden pavement to do a job I don't have the staff to delegate to, which in turn gets in the way of my recruiting the warm bodies I need in order to do this kind of thing without getting my feet wet. Wonderful. I've spent the past decade working for an intelligence organisation rather than the police. The rules are, shall we say, different over there. The auditors have fed me just enough uncertainty about Jim to alarm me, but not enough to give me any preconceptions about the cause for their concern. In the absence of evidence against him, he's still a vital part of my team. I hate the word indispensable, because it's a sign that you don't have a working organisation, just a bunch of temporarily cooperating individuals. But the sad fact is, I don't have an organisation. I have a superhero team. Maybe in another couple of months I'll have Teams Alpha through Delta and a duty superhero roster and a training budget and a sickness leave chart to track. But right now, my team has all the logistical flexibility of a strip of balsa wood. So I can't wrap Jim up in cotton wool and run him through a loyalty test maze. I've got to depend on him to get the job done, despite not being able to fully trust him. As if that's not bad enough. I can't even talk this over with Bob. For one thing, I don't have a life of my own anymore. I'm spending a day and a half a week at the police college in Hendon, being given my very own accelerated catch-up course in being a really wet-behind-the-ears rookie trainee policewoman, with the added twist that I'm on MI5's management org chart on payroll with a department of an organisation, SOE, that was officially wound up in 1945, and I'm supposed to command a small and very weird police force all of my very own, with a chief superintendent working under me. If you want to map out my management matrix without getting hopelessly tangled up, you'll need to draw it on the surface of a Klein bottle. The homework alone keeps me up until midnight on those days when the job doesn't. I've lost track of my friends. I don't even know how Sandy's baby bump is progressing this month, and, trust me on this, when one of your friends is pregnant, not getting daily or at least weekly updates is a sign that you're really out of the loop. Finally, Bob isn't even in London most of the time. It turns out that Angleton left little piles of metaphysical unexploded ordnance all over the country, and Bob's being kept busy scurrying all over the map, itemising, neutralising, and containerising them. It's not that Angleton was particularly untidy. He just got to work in a lot of offices over nearly 8 decades of service. So, about all I see of my husband is his name on my phone when he has time to call, which is maybe twice a week, and vice versa. Believe me, this does not make me happy. A house cat is no adequate substitute for a life partner, even when she isn't trying to kill me in my sleep. But let's get back to the enigma inside a conundrum that is Jim Gray / Officer Friendly. If he was inside the laundry, the auditors could carpet him and ask some extremely pointed questions under sanction of his oath of loyalty. Our take on internal security is that if we secure the soul, the flesh will obey. Footnote. There are some disturbing exceptions. I'm still not privy to the analysis of how Iris Carpenter perverted her gesh to the point where she could survive questioning. But in general, we have a lower level of internal threats than other security organisations, and no whistleblowers, even though the existence of the Iris loophole means there is no room for complacency. But Jim isn't in the laundry. He's a senior police officer who has lately, and semi-publicly, acquired superpowers. The laundry can't recruit him and hush everything up, the way we used to do with adepts who showed signs of occult talent or computer science geeks who tripped over the Turing theses. All the auditors can do is nudge him into this neither fish nor fowl unit I'm running, then get me to poke him and see if he jumps in a self-incriminating direction, and hope that if he does, I can bring him down before he does any damage. That's assuming the SA's suspicions are justified, of course. I like Jim. He seems to be a genuine straight arrow who is also a deep enough thinker to regularly surprise me with his insights. The SA is usually rock solid, but the idea that Jim could be some kind of criminal seems so misguided as to be laughable. But, as Jim himself pointed out, the most effective criminals are the ones who move the fence posts of the law to protect their activities. The ones you can't even build a case against. Treason never prospers. I approach the barred and boarded frontage of Aldwych Station along the Strand, past the front of King's College. A steady rain falls beneath a slate-coloured overcast that suggests it has set in for the day. Buses and taxis rumble past, spraying water across the pavement whenever they plough through a puddle by a block drain. I walk as close to the buildings as possible. The station itself presents a narrow frontage to the road, red tiles framing a wide double doorway, closed off by a security grille, beneath a semicircular window. One side of the security mesh is drawn back, and one door stands ajar. A policeman stands inside, waiting just out of the rain. "Mo," calls a voice behind me. I turn just in time to see Jim hurrying along the pavement. He's in working uniform, with a high-vis waterproof on top. "Good to see you. I was just about to..." I gesture at the entrance. The officer in the doorway raises a hand. "You can't come in." I hold up my warrant card. "O'Brien, TPCF. I'm here to see Inspector Hoare." I show him my teeth. "My colleague here is Chief Superintendent Gray."
"Ah, right."
He takes in Jim and his eyes widen as he falls back, retreating into the shadowed station lobby.
"Please wait here, sir. Mom, I'll be right back."
He scampers away hastily. I glance at Jim. "Shall we?" Jim gestures. "Off to you." The interior of the disused tube station is a bit grubby, but otherwise in remarkably good repair. The floor tiles are uncracked, and the wood panels on the walls are still solid. There's no rubbish, no sign of peeling paint or graffiti. But the frames for information posters and advertisements are empty. The ticket barriers are archaic. There isn't a single Oyster card reader in sight, and I haven't seen that style of glass-fronted booth in ages. It takes me all the way back to nostalgia-tinged memories of childhood. A school trip to the big city many years before I came to make my home here. It's hard to see into the station beyond the ticket barriers. I can just about make out a broad corridor with shadowed openings to either side, but I see no sign of escalators. The Piccadilly line runs deep, and land prices in this part of London are high. This must have been one of the stations designed to be served by lifts. The constable who was on door duty comes hurrying back, leading Inspector Hoare, a bluff-looking guy, who eyeballs us briefly and straightens his back at the sight of Jim's shoulder flashes. He looks as if he's just swallowed a frog. You expected the monkey. You shouldn't be surprised when she brings the organ grinder along. This is Chief Super Jim Gray, from TPCF, I tell him. I'm Dr. O'Brien, TPCF Director. I show him just enough of a smile to draw the sting. Now, suppose you show us what's wrong. Yes, absolutely. This way. He waves us through the dead ticket barriers. Watch your footing. There's been a leak in here recently and the floor can be slippery. He lifts up a torch and points it at a pitch-black tunnel behind the barriers. That's the passage to the passenger lifts down to the platform. They're missing. I follow Jim forward, keeping my eyes peeled. It's a not dissimilar layout to the other lift-only underground stations. A stubby corridor, terminating in a dead end, lift doors to either side. Except where the doors should be, there are solid stainless steel panels. They glint dully in Jim's torch beam. These panels aren't supposed to be here? Definitely not. They're supposed to be sliding doors, opening onto functioning lifts. And there's more. Hoare walks past us in the direction of a door at the end of the passage, labelled Staff Only. He produces a huge bunch of battered-looking keys and unlocks it. This is a spiral staircase. Emergency exit. You really do not want to have to use it. There are over 200 steps. At least, there were yesterday. He pulls the door open to reveal another stainless steel panel. These aren't some kind of regular barrier? Asks Jim. Fitted during maintenance. Maybe TFL have some work scheduled. Sorry, sir. Hoare sounds anything but sorry. Already excluded. That was the first thing we looked into. Jim steps close to the sheet of metal. He twists the head of his torch until the beam is dazzlingly sharp, then slowly directs it around the edges of the frame. I see no prints or tracks. No, sir. Looks like it was installed from the rear side. It's the same with the lift shafts. How do you take over a disused tube station? Well, if you can come in from below, you can move heavy equipment into place without anyone noticing up top. The trouble is in the from-below bit. The tube network is one of the most heavily travelled railway systems in the UK. Yes, it shuts down for 4 to 5 hours every night while they kill the traction power and carry out cleaning and maintenance work. But that doesn't mean it's deserted. Quite the opposite. It should be crawling with staff and contractors. We should take a look at the block tunnel entrance, I say aloud. I can sort that out, says Hoare. But I'm not saying you'll find it useful. And look up everyone who's had maintenance access to the branch line in the past year. Hoare twitches. Now that is an interesting question. Later, standing just back from the odd experimental warning signs at the end of Platform 5, under Holborn, I check my watch. It's pushing 11. I'm keeping you from your meeting, I tell Jim. This doesn't need both of us. Frankly, I think it's a wild goose chase, and I'd just as soon throw it back at... I already cancelled. Jim is dismissive. While I should, strictly speaking, be flying a desk, it does me good to get out once in a while and stick my nose into the real world. Even if it's a less productive use of my time than organising people and issuing policy directives. Which this isn't, by the way. Unproductive use of time, I mean. Mine or yours. The more experience of routine investigations you get, the better you'll understand the needs of the police units you're supporting. There is something wrong with Jim's analysis. Something very slightly off-kilter. But it takes me a few seconds to put my finger on it. He's looking at my responsibilities purely from a policing point of view. He's put me in a frame and moved it sideways, obscuring part of the big picture of what the Home Office needs. much less what the laundry is trying to accomplish here, and focusing on his own preoccupations. Does he expect me to go native? But then again, he is a cop. It would be weird if he didn't view everything in terms of his own organisation's needs. I'm about to mention this to him, when the tracks beside the deserted platform begin to rattle and hum. A bright yellow locomotive comes rolling out of the tunnel at the opposite end of the platform at walking pace. It's a battery electric locomotive, one of the maintenance machines that can operate in the tube tunnels when the traction current is switched off. It grates to a halt just before it reaches us. The ventilation fans on the panels covering its immense lead acid battery packs humming. The driver opens his door.
"O'Brien and Gray?" he asks.
"That's us," Jim says.
He climbs aboard and I follow him. The cab is surprisingly cramped. It's short enough that there isn't room for me to lay Lecter's case on the floor in a straight line from front to back. The seats are padded flaps that fold down from the rear wall. Our driver is a short, wiry guy in TFL uniform and Sikh turban.
"What do you want to see today?"
he asks. "I think we'd like to look at the Aldwych branch line," I say brightly. To my irritation, he doesn't respond until Jim echoes me.
"We hear it's been blocked off overnight, and we want to take a look at the obstruction." "Right, that's what I thought. Let me call Earl's Court and confirm."
He picks up an antiquated-looking Bakelite phone handset and begins speaking in an oddly formal steam-powered dialect of air traffic control jargon. When he hangs up, he looks at us, avoiding my eyes.
"We'll be moving soon."
We wait. And we wait some more. And suddenly, the red light we're staring at just outside the tunnel mouth goes out, and a green light goes on above it, and we begin to move forward. I haul out my smartphone and point it out the windscreen recording video.
"Eyes left," says Jim.
I pan to take in the left-hand side of the tunnel. We slowly gather speed until we're rattling along at what seems like a terrific clip, but is probably no more than 10 miles per hour. More signal lights appear in the tunnel ahead, green, with a diagonal white slash illuminated above them.
"That's us," says the driver.
We begin to slow. I glance at the tachograph in front of the driver and see it's reading 7 or 8 miles per hour. So that's how fast we're going, when we see the red light ahead, and he throws on the brakes. We screech to a halt in plenty of time to see the bricked-up circle of the dead end ahead of us. The track, ending at a pair of suspiciously shiny-looking buffers.
"That's not supposed to be there," our driver complains. "It wasn't there yesterday."
He sounds as if he's doubting his own sanity.
"What wasn't?"
I ask.
"The buffers. That wall,"
he points.
"There's supposed to be another half mile of track, then the western platform, with an old Northern Line train parked alongside it."
"You're telling me someone just walled off a tube tunnel overnight?"
Jim sounds as disbelieving as I feel.
"Oh, yes."
Our driver checks a couple of dials, then throws a big switch.
"All righty, that's the end of the line. Now, if you'd care to follow me single file to the other cab, it's time to go back."
I get back to the office just after lunchtime and steal 10 minutes to type up a report on whatever the hell just ate my morning. I upload the video from my phone and email it to Sam for his urgent attention. Then, head for the first of what promises to be a lengthy series of sessions with a pair of very sympathetic investigators from the IPCC. My afternoon is then enriched immeasurably by an hour with a senior body from Human Resources at SSHQ, then half an hour alone with my homework. I am ploughing my way through Butterworth's police law in my spare time, wondering what I did in a previous life to deserve this. And then a briefing by 2 amiable health and safety folks who are here to give me a helpful orientation briefing on what I can do to contribute to a healthy and safe workplace environment.
not going head-to-head with neo-Nazi superpowered hooligans or maniacs possessed by Class 4 demons would be a good start. Not being trusted to carry around a necromantic occult artifact with a taste for souls that talks to me in my sleep would be another. But as Bob would say, I digress. Around 5, I find myself in another meeting. This time, it's with Ramona and Mary, who in the past few weeks have gone from triggering panic attacks to being among the more comfortingly predictable elements of my life. Strange days indeed.
So, I got the CRB and Hans checks through on the torch in Busy Bee, says Mary. And the good news is, they're clean enough for our purposes. Busy Bee had a checkered childhood, but were required to ignore anything prior to the 18th birthday, except convictions in adult court for serious criminal offences, and she was basically an activist. Went on marches, not burglaries. From university onwards, she's been politically engaged, but at the good citizen end of the spectrum. We might have a headache if we were vetting her for the laundry, but for the Home Office, well, we can kick this up a level if necessary. It's not as if we're overflowing with candidates, is it? As for the torch, he's boringly clean. Good. If you have any doubts, you should ask Jim about B's background and what it means. Do you want to invite them back for a second interview if the news is good? I ask.
We can do that, she says. She sounds pleased with herself.
Should Jim sit in on this round?
Yes, about that, I say, and give them a dump of my current thoughts on the subject. It's not that I don't trust him because of... I point at the ceiling. But more a case of my not wanting him to hitch our little red wagon too tightly to his own special interests. We have to keep the big picture in mind. We operate with the privileges and duties of police officers, but we are not here solely to provide the Met or ACPO with backup. We need police powers, because we have to operate in public. But we're not here to play cops and robbers with bad guys. There's a reason we've got the word coordination in our name.
As you say.
Mary looks as if she's chewing it over. Meanwhile, Ramona has another issue to raise.
Are we on to any other business yet? Have you had any new thoughts about the uniform question?
I twitch, remembering the fate of my number 2 suit. There's definitely a case for us to have protective gear available for field work. I'm less sure about the brief for us to play superhero dress-up. How far did you get with that anyway?
I put in a bit of time earlier in the week and came up with some ideas, yes.
Ramona wakes her tablet, swipes a few times to bring up an image, and spins it around so Mary and I can see it.
What do you think?
I think, I pause, it looks very Daft Punk. Or maybe Daft Punk goes territorial support group / SWAT team.
Part of our remit is to counter the cult of personality that goes with the whole public perception of superheroes, Ramona points out. Nothing tilts the scale away from grandstanding individual and towards organisation body like having a de-individualising uniform. Any uniform you decide we should standardise on needs to define a corporate identity, unavoidably one that plays off existing police uniforms, because of the nature of the organisation. It also needs to provide protection from hazards, and you said you wanted to avoid the cheesecake problem. By which, she means the popular expectation that women with exotic powers should wear 6-inch stilettos, fishnets, and implausible corsetry, while courting hypothermia as they fight crime. An expectation which has more to do with the historic age and gender distribution of the Weekly Comics consumer demographic than with, for example, a fang's desire to avoid exposure to sunlight, or my own strong preference not to show off my impending middle-aged spread. I look at Ramona's proposed outfits. The chrome and silver motorcycle helmets, with odd bumps for antennae, and mirrored glass faceplates. I can see why that would appeal to Mary. The pointy top to the helmet, with the blue beacon, is an obvious shout-out to Officer Friendly's kit. The rest of the outfit reminds me of something else.
These are motorcycle leathers.
Actually, they're Kevlar, Ramona explains.
with cervical airbags and extra padding around ankles, kneecaps and elbows. Just like high-end biker kit. But they're actually next-generation riot gear. It looks like motorcycle protective gear because it's designed to do much the same job. Provide whole-body protection from blunt or sharp trauma and being thrown about. The cervical airbag is a biker thing, and bikers are taking to them to save their necks when they put down a ride at high speed. It seems to me that if we end up going hand-to-hand against someone with super strength, they'll be a lifesaver, or at least a spinal injury preventer. I've also specced out earth chainmail inserts in case of lightning or tasers, and heavy-duty wards in case of the usual. I take your point, I see carefully. But isn't the overall effect a bit Darth Vader? I mean, all you need to add is a cape and a lightsaber. We're supposed to be operating as police, not Imperial stormtroopers. What message does this look send? I am the law, motherfucker. Are you feeling lucky? Suggests Ramona. People. I pause for a moment. Remind me of Peel's principles of policing again. Ramona looks blank. Mary looks sceptical. Policing by consent? I hint. Come on, the basic rules we play by. Minimum use of force to achieve compliance. The performance of a police force is judged best by how little crime takes place on their watch, rather than by how many heads they kick in, that kind of thing. Since when do flying chavs with the ability to set fire to anything they look at consent to be policed? Mary crosses her arms. We don't get called out until there's already a public order problem. At which point, she looks to Ramona for support. If a little bit of preemptive intimidation saves us from having to fight, I'm all in favour of it, she agrees. I stare at the blueprints for the Mark I Home Office Imperial Stormtrooper uniform some more. The male version comes over as distinctly Judge Dredd, but the female-fitted variant is mercifully cleavage-free, doesn't show off the wearer's cellulite, and has boots that look like they'd be more at home kicking down doors than tottering around a bordello. Need to sleep on this, huh? Next item. Mary, did you get anywhere with the origin story? Mary shakes her head tiredly. I was talking to Jez Wilson, Jerry Lockhart, and Pete Russell. They formed an ad hoc committee to draw together a big lie suitable for public disclosure that remains consistent with everything that's already accidentally leaked. It's not just a front-page story, but a bunch of elaborate conspiracy theories to satisfy the tinfoil hat crowd. The headliner is that it's a mutant descendant of SARS, but the backup stories blame the Fukushima meltdowns, mercury preservatives and vaccines, and a rogue nanobiological warfare experiment by the US government. Well, I stare at Mary. She stares back at me. I take it you're not happy with these options. Are you? She shoots right back. Dumb and dumber. I shake my head. On the other hand, the kind of people who obsess at length about where superpowers come from. We just need to distract them for a couple more years. Mary reminds me. Make them keep chasing after half-truths and lies. Sooner or later, Case Nightmare Green is going to leak. It's just a matter of time. And then we won't need an origin story anymore. Well, I resist the urge to clutch my head. I suppose you're right, in the long term, but none of those are exactly helpful. Why not? Asks Ramona. Because they all push epidemic or pollution narratives. I resist the urge to snap. They paint us as contaminated. It's deeply unsettling to ordinary members of the public because it has echoes of ritual uncleanliness that go back a long way. The whole superhero narrative is flawed anyway. It's a stand-in for the old-time Greek and Roman pantheons, ultra-powerful gods with dysfunctional emotional lives. We're going to be perceived as unstable by default. And now we've got some committee trying to convince us to play the part of contaminated untouchables? You've got to admit, it's a step up from Dracula, Mary says dryly. Well, I try not to roll my eyes. Then I remember my early morning legwork. Which reminds me. Something new came up this morning. I tell them about Aldwych, then add the latest report from Sam. The actual tunnel entrance has been blocked with brick, backed with reinforced concrete. Nobody's sure how thick it is, but it's a very professional job. TfL are looking into the maintenance contractor's logs to see who might have had access to the spur tunnel. But it's possible whoever decided to block it off ran an entire train load of cement, aggregate, and other construction materials inside before they did the deed.
How much tunnel are we talking about?
Ramona asks. I read my email, repeating the highlights aloud. Two tunnels with platforms connected via an overhead walkway. We're looking at 1 kilometre of underground railway tunnel and two platforms, one of which has been converted with its track section replaced by offices, storage facilities, and a 1950s hostel for immigrant labourers, which is said to be haunted. I'm not making that up. I look up from my tablet. Any suggestions? Miri is sceptical.
Doesn't sound like superpowers to me. Sounds like the opposite, in fact. Someone without superpowers. Like, oh, maybe another department that didn't tell TfL they were borrowing a semi-surplus tube station for something. Ministry of Defence? They used to use the deep tube tunnels for bomb-proof storage. But why?
Wild goose chase, Mo, Ramona says firmly. Just because the transport police thought it was flaky, it does not follow that it's our kind of flaky.
I really do roll my eyes this time.
You think they gulled me?
I didn't say that.
I notice Ramona's shared glance with Mary.
You should consider taking some time off. I know you think you've got a lot of catching up to do, but you can only work 70 hours a week with homework on top for so long before you burn out.
Yes, says Mary. You're not a 20-something, Mo. You don't have the stamina.
And you do. You're a...
I catch myself just in time.
Yes,
she snaps.
I can work 100 hours a week if I have to. I just have to drink someone's...
She takes a deep breath.
It's not worth it. Not unless it's an emergency. Mo, we need you intact. You've been going at the job like a lunatic since we got back from Manchester. Apart from that radio you listen to after everyone else clocks off, you've got no outlets. But it's business as usual. What happens if an emergency comes up and you've got no reserves? We don't have a fully formed management structure. We haven't in-processed the new recruits for training yet. We've been in business for barely a month. You're still a single point of failure for the unit, and you're actively damaging yourself.
Mo, please.
Ramona joins in on her side before I can reply.
Take some time off. If you're going to work weekends, at least give yourself 3 evenings a week when you clock off at 6 and don't come in until 9 the next morning. Or start taking your weekends seriously. Or something.
I look between them, feeling bewildered by their betrayal. On a coldly rational level, they're absolutely right. But on a gut level, it feels like a stab in the back.
You planned this.
Yes, Mo.
Ramona gives me a look that suddenly makes me wonder how I look to her right now.
You're not going to slow down on your own, are you? You've been running with the brakes off ever since the treaty meeting.
She stops as Mary looks away from me briefly, tension evident in the set of her neck. Oh. Yes, I am probably working too hard. I've got a department to set up, an insufficient staff and support, and besides, what is there waiting for me to go home to? A cat? A bed haunted by ghosts? Yes, I admit my dancing partner has been back for a few whirls around the nightmare, and has given me a pointed nudge or two in the direction of an evil dream opera score. But that's why I'm doing it. That's why I'm working every day until I drop. It's the only way to be sure I'll sleep soundly. I'll think about it.
You'll have to do better than that.
Mary winds up to badger me again. I'm not sure how she's doing this. Her body language reads scared / juggling live grenades. Am I still that frightening?
It'll be nightfall in, oh, another hour. You can go home, but wouldn't you rather come out with us? Girls' night out, team-building exercise, whatever you want to call it.
I don't feel much like dancing, thanks.
You don't have to. You just have to let go of the job for a few hours. Can you even do that anymore? Because if not, you just prove my point.
Oh, hell. I surrender. She's got me banged to rights.
If you've got nothing better to do than drag me round wine bars for an evening, I shall just have to surrender gracefully.
I force myself to smile. In truth, there's a knot of tension behind my sternum that does not dissolve in relief at the idea of spending an evening in the company of a vampire and a mermaid, who both once upon a time had carnal relationships with my currently separated husband. It sounds dangerously like a mash-up of the Addams Family with Friends. And if that doesn't have you reaching for the Gaviscon, your stomach is stronger than mine. But on the other hand, it's an excuse to avoid a certain textbook that's been gnawing at my brain of late. And we don't have to talk about Bob. Let me wrap up in here, and I'll see you at 7. And that is the start of a slippery slope, which ends with me standing on a spotlit stage to give the performance of my life to an audience of thousands, bewitched by a mad scientist, blood trickling from my fingertips as I struggle for control of the melody that will usher in the overture to the end of the world. But that doesn't happen until much later.
Part 3. Good heavens, Miss Sakamoto. You're beautiful. Chapter 13. Captivation. We meet in the lobby a whisker after 7 and form a post-work posse. One of those groups of hard-partying office ladies you see around central London after working hours. In our case, the partying is relatively sedate. One of us is in a wheelchair. Another can't go anywhere with black light illumination. And I'm over 40 and have been working so hard, I'm feeling my age. Luckily, there's a nice little bistro around the corner that has a duck confit to die for. A shelf of fascinating artisanal London gins, which they serve in ancient jam jars, and modern jazz background music that doesn't set my teeth on edge. So that's where we start, with the idea of working our way on from there. We eat, and we talk, and Ramona and Mary systematically steal the conversation whenever I try to steer it back towards work. To my horror, they want to talk about personal stuff. But not my personal stuff, their personal stuff. Ramona has been stuck in a very expensive hotel room since she arrived. She needs a whirlpool bath more than she needs a bed. And she's having difficulty looking for a flat to rent that is wheelchair accessible and has a suitable bathroom but doesn't cost a bazillion pounds a week. On the other hand, she's commuting from the North Sea each weekend. I just go home and head for the unthinking depths, she says, where I school. You couldn't make it up. Mary looks at her enviously.
No strings on me,
she says uptight. Ramona, of course, takes this as a challenge and enlists my assistance in crowbarring Mary open. By the third large glass of Pinot, I wish she hadn't. I've learned more than I ever wanted to about Mary's problems hanging onto long-term boyfriends, even before she contracted her unfortunate condition.
It's funny. I should have gotten my fangs into him a lot harder, except I didn't have fangs back then,
she says of her most recent ex. She chuckles unhappily at some personal joke that I don't get, then upends the last few drops from the bottle into her glass.
You don't know what you've got until it slips through your fingers.
This strikes uncomfortably close to home. So I ask them whether they're also wondering if these 3 sigma and above superpowers are on a one-way trip to K-Syndrome City, thereby giving them an excuse to glare at me and change the subject. derailing. Three can play at that game. We manage to hit another wine bar, but it's only just past 10 o'clock, when I realise I'm yawning so furiously, I have to excuse myself. I'm wobbling on my feet, and not just from 3 glasses of wine. The Japanese have a word for it, of course. Karoshi. Death. Through overwork. I'm tired and tipsy. So instead of grappling with bus and tube, I use an app to call a private hire cab. I pay cash, and the driver drops me at my front door, where I stagger in, go straight upstairs, and faceplant on the bed. It's my first undisturbed and dreamless night of sleep in ages. A week passes. I attend more meetings and training courses than seems humanly possible, get politely grilled by an assistant undersecretary to the Home Office. Actually, a terrifyingly senior civil servant, but I'm properly prepared for our session this time. Get our proposed uniforms redesignated as protective clothing, which applies a whole different regulatory brush to them and totally gives me cover for banishing skin-tight lycra from the picture forever. It's a fire risk, don't you know? Then spend an inconclusive and somewhat lachrymose evening with Bob before he ships out to Belize to inspect a ruined temple in the jungle that Angleton vandalized 30 years ago for some reason. I am failing to exercise properly, eating badly, and working too hard. I can't shake the feeling that I'm underqualified for this job and I'll be found out at any time. Also, that it's not a role I'm temperamentally suited to. On the other hand, with M and R tag-teaming me, I am keeping back 3 evenings a week for myself. I continue to play my instrument, periodically misuse Dr. Armstrong's office as a confessional, and maintain level flight rather than embarking on a downward spiral. Which is about the best I can hope for, under the circumstances. Later in the week, and to everybody's surprise, 2 new analysts and a receptionist join the team. And then our first 2 actual card-carrying Home Office superheroes arrive. The Torch and Busy Bee. The Torch is 19 and comes from Macclesfield. He's about 190 centimetres tall, painfully skinny, but stronger than he looks, and not academically inclined. Descended from mill workers, Dad's a builder, Mum's a plumber, scraped a couple of GCSE passes, and left school at 16 to follow Dad into the building trade. Ambition. To work his way all the way to the top, which is defined by the rarefied job description of skilled bricklayer. Which, to his credit, he was on course to become. Until 3 months ago, when he discovered that he could light cigarettes by snapping his fingers. Then bonfires. Then convert a 50-quid B&Q barbecue into a blazing molten Dali sculpture, which is when the Macclesfield Express dubbed him The Torch, and offered him a cape and a mask, in return for an extremely silly front-page photo op. Prior to us inviting him down to the Big Smoke for an interview, his furthest excursion from home was via Manchester Airport for a package holiday in Marbella when he turned 18. The poor lad is utterly out of his depth and painfully naive. But he means well, and seems to cotton to the idea of a higher calling in the police. As long as I assign someone to wipe his nose and ensure he has a fresh change of underwear every morning, he ought to pull through the seething mass of culture shock that is his first exposure to London. Busy Bee is going to be more of a handful, but I think I've got a grip on where she's coming from, if not where she's going. She's 26, and has a file with the Met's Forward Intelligence Unit that had me arguing back and forth with Jim for days before we agreed to see her. The file was opened in her late teens, back in the bad old days, when the Met were doing stuff we don't admit we do anymore because it's not allowed. Stuff like spying on domestic terrorists, political activists, or, in Bee's case, teenage feminists. Some throwback in Fit was terrified that she might hurl herself under the King's racehorse at the Grand National. After all, If it could happen in 1913, surely it's still a clear and present danger. Votes for women still being a notoriously controversial political hot potato in the 21st century. Consequently, her file is the police equivalent of green kryptonite, except that she hasn't actually ever been charged with, much less convicted of, anything. So let's provisionally refile her record under movie prop kryptonite and move swiftly on. It turns out that her Apis agilis comes from a long line, well, at least one generation, of New Statesman reading bolshy teacher activists of the kind the education secretary sees under every bed. Dad rose to the dizzy height of town councillor, while Mum continues to teach social sciences at a former polytechnic. B got involved in reproductive rights activism in her teens, went on counter demos against anti-abortion activists, and generally made a bit of a buzz. Then, she headed off to university to study political science and economics as a prelude to taking over the world, and lowered her sights to taking over one student society at a time, for course credits on the poli-sci side of her degree. This was before she acquired the ability to speed herself up by a factor of 10, which happened 10 weeks ago, when she darted into a busy road to rescue a runaway 2-year-old from a runaway cement mixer, under the unblinking gaze of an experimental high-def traffic camera. TV news coverage ensued, followed by the usual 15 minutes of fame, condensed down in her case to a 90-second feel-good slot at the end of the hourly cycle. She can only do it as long as she can hold her breath. She can't absorb oxygen or discharge carbon dioxide from the linings of her lungs while in super speed mode. But what she can accomplish in that time is impressive. During our skills matrix review, Ramona added, "Can administer wedgies at a rate of 5 supervillains per second." To the checklist. I was tempted to leave it in, despite the home sec's notoriously unpredictable sense of humour. And though I cut it in the end, it's not far from the forefront of my thinking about how we could deploy her. Also, she's cute, in a petite black with yellow stripes and dimples sort of way. All we need is for our next pair of candidates to clear the enhanced CRB checks, and we might even be able to start training them for deployment. One afternoon, I'm in a meeting with Jim and the analysts, now augmented by Gillian and Kareem, two new transfers from the laundry, when the Met ECC phones me to pass on the unwelcome news that the elusive Professor Freudstein has struck again. Ironically, it happens while we're sitting around a table brainstorming possible approaches to the nascent mad scientist menace. Freudstein, and our signal lack of success in getting a lead on him, not to mention his stolen £40 million and rare musical score collection, is a persistent irritant. One of a growing list of problems that are on our collective to-do list, along with the likes of the mandate. We'll get around to them just as soon as the agency is fully staffed and ready to move from setup to active operations, honest. Until then, all we can really do is map out the beat we're going to have to patrol. For his part, Jim is convinced that the MSM is real. "Freudstein looks like a fairly plausible type specimen," he explains. "And that's disturbing, because the thing about criminals of a given type is that for everyone we know about, there are usually 4 more we don't. Also, we haven't managed to collar him yet, which is not a good sign." "Yes, but our prior probabilities are..." I stop dead, realizing there's stuff I can't talk about with Jim. Sam and Nick are cleared. Gillian and Kareem, coming from the laundry, are also cleared. I could talk to them about Ellis Billington and Jennifer Morgue if necessary. But while Jim is cleared for joint operations that require police liaison, I'm not inclined to be loose-lipped about other operations around him, as long as the SA isn't certain he's on the up-and-up. Even operations that are over and dead and buried. Anyway, Billington wasn't exactly a mad scientist. Mad businessman, maybe. But scientist? I'm not so sure. I clear my throat, then hesitantly finish my sentence with, "Unclear."
"Not really,"
Gillian volunteers brightly. "We've seen several Three Sigma instances of intelligence enhancement in the past few months. For example, there's Brain Box, who aced Brain of Britain last month and maxed out on Mensa's IQ test. There may be many more low-grade examples, but they don't stick out like a sore thumb. Intelligence isn't like flight or pyrokinesis. It's something all of us have. Anyway, you don't have to be terribly intelligent to complete a PhD," Karim grumps. "You just need to be stupidly persistent. If anything, being too smart gets in the way." "How would you proactively identify a mad scientist anyway?" asks Sam, dragging the round table back on topic before Karim starts fulminating about the state of his student loans. Jim responds. "Let's see. Traditional mad scientists aren't team players, are they? And science is very much a team sport this century. You could probably go some way towards narrowing the field by looking for sudden resignations from research groups or by hunting for researchers who've suddenly stopped publishing. He makes it sound so easy. Unfortunately, the lead time on publishing a peer-reviewed paper is months to years. So there's a lot of lag in the system." He continues to undermine his own case. "And researchers quit for any number of reasons. They have babies, or they take a highly paid job offer from a bank, or they just get bored and take up martial arts. That happened to one really famous mathematician. These days, she's the world's third-ranking female cage fighter." "Cage-fighting mathematicians? Violin-playing philosophers? Now that I think about it, there's probably room in our unit for an epistemologist to work on theory of supervillains. I wonder idly if I could convince someone else to take over as director, so I can step down and colonize that niche, then shake myself. We're not here to discuss ex-scientists. We're here to figure out how to proactively identify mad ones with 4 or 5 Sigma superpowers," I remind him. "Although it does seem to be a rather difficult project." Karim speaks up again. "Rather than looking for signs of emergence, maybe we could look at their goals instead," he asks diffidently. "Has Freudstein said what he wants?" "No," says Jim. He frowns, looking as worried as I feel. "And if he did, could we trust him to tell the truth about his motivations? Mad scientists aren't really a problem unless they're also brilliant. That's part of the problem space. Dumb mad scientists would be a bit pathetic. I think we can ignore them. Ditto the lazy variety. So, we're looking for hyper-intelligent, energetic mad scientists. And the brilliant ones are going to tell us whatever they think is most likely to cause us to do whatever they want us to do, rather than gloating about their real motivations." "Like what?" I ask. "What would a mad scientist conceivably want us to do?" The question hangs in the air, like an unexploded grenade. Jim, so highly articulate most of the time, is actually unable to frame a reply. After a moment, he explains. "Freudstein has very efficiently raised hell while concealing his motivations, so I'd have to say, insufficient data. So we need to focus on gathering data." I smile at him to diffuse the implied criticism and continue. "It seems to me that mad science can't come cheap. They would obviously need a research center or lab of their own, and the money to pay for equipment and materials and electricity. Also, minions to do the legwork, install equipment, run experiments, keep records, do statistical analysis. And we know Freudstein has minions. Unless he started by figuring out how to clone himself for the British Library robbery. So we're not looking for an Igor. We're hunting an entire team of disillusioned postdoc researchers whose parent institutions didn't renew their rolling annual employment contract and who think they're working for a respectable company doing research into whatever the mad scientist wants. The flip side is that scientific research is a bottomless money pit. You can approximate doing science to standing on the crack of doom, throwing banknotes down it by the double handful, in the hope that if you choke the volcano with enough paper, it will cough up the one ring. Unless you're doing pure mathematics or philosophy, of course. In which case, it's HB pencils and ruled A4 notepads all the way down. So, where there's a mad scientist pursuing their hobby horse? Even if it's something as innocuous as developing a new taxonomy of wood-boring beetles, I think we're likely to find some kind of low-input, high-output income stream, operating with questionable regard to legality. So we'd be looking for organisations that keep a low public profile, employ a fair number of high-powered staff who go about their tasks in secret, and which are headed by people who picked up a PhD or two by accident before they heard their true calling. Finally, they'd have an incredibly opaque income stream. Identifying such organisations is really a job for the National Crime Agency, who can distinguish a mad scientist menace from a regular organised crime ring by profiling the folks at the top. Of course, this breaks down if, by a huge coincidence, our mad scientist is the heir to the Duchy of Cornwall or the alter ego of the Duke of Westminster, in which case we're looking for a demented lord spending money like water. But that's a low probability, I believe. I look at Jim. What do you think? Jim looks slightly taken aback.
Are you sure you're not a mad scientist yourself?
He asks.
You've certainly got a grip on the psychological profile and your ability to monologue.
That's when my phone rings. O'Brien speaking. It's our new receptionist, Lizzie.
Dr. O'Brien, I've got a call for you from the Emergency Control Centre at New Scotland Yard. Inspector Cooper on the line.
Thanks. Put them through. Hello? Inspector? I'm Dr. O'Brien. You asked for me?
Yes. You're flagged on our alert list to be advised of any developments involving alias Professor Freudstein?
I am, yes. I sit up straight. Across the table, I see everyone staring at me.
We have just received a communication from Freudstein, or someone claiming to be them. The call originated with a previously inactive prepaid phone bought in cash from a major supermarket chain 6 months ago, somewhere in Edgware. We're trying to locate the phone and its carrier now, but it looks like the call was planned to minimise traceability. The caller said they were speaking on behalf of Professor Freudstein, specified that you, that is, Dr. Dominique O'Brien, Transhuman Police Coordination Force, were to be notified. And he gave a code word, previously associated with the perpetrators of a previously unattributed incident 3 days ago.
What was the previous? I ask.
I'm sorry. I'm not at liberty to tell you. You need to take it up through channels. Superintendent Drummond at CNC Sellafield can brief you. The code word Freudstein said to associate with your name is Infinity Concerto. Whatever that means.
I end the call, hyperventilating. Freudstein coming to the attention of the civil nuclear constabulary can't be good. Jim gets there first.
I heard Freudstein?
Sellafield, I say bleakly. Freudstein did something there 3 days ago. He's just claimed responsibility and given us a code word. And he's hanging it on my neck.
Sellafield?
That's Kareem. He sounds shocked. I look at Jim. We need to get in touch with the Superintendent Drummond. Find out what the hell is going on and why Freudstein wants to talk. Because they never hand you a code word, unless they want to talk, from a position of strength. Can you follow this up for me?
Yes.
Jim stands up.
I'll go make some calls.
Looks like Freudstein's decided to give us some actual insights into the mad scientist menace. Let's just hope they're not misleading and deadly. 6 o'clock rolls around, and I'm still in the office. One ear tuned to the radio. Late summer is the prom season. The mammoth sequence of standing room-only concerts, that are to classical music in London, as Wimbledon is to tennis. So there's a new concert broadcast from the Albert Hall just about every night. I'm using it to try to distract myself from worrying about that call while I update